those of you who found Flaherty's comments to be somewhat controversial, I think we'll be in for a little bit more of a controversy for this evening. When we approach a very thorny topic, which is the chosen people doctrine of Judaism. Yes, cell phones off, thank you very much. When we approach a doctrine within Judaism, which my personal feeling is has gotten a lot of unfair negative press. And what I mean by that is that we all know that what we espouse and that the Jewish people claim to be the chosen people has gotten us into trouble in history. A lot of times persecution has arisen against the Jewish people specifically because we have prided ourselves as being the Am Segula, the Am HaNivchar, the chosen people. And as a matter of fact, you know, certain anti-Semitic creeds like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion are filled with this whole attitude that the Jewish people feel that because they are the chosen people that they have a right to rise up against the world and to form their own cadre of scholars who can basically run the world covertly and make all the decisions for the world because they pride themselves as being the chosen people. And this, of course, is an excuse that people who choose to be anti-Semitic will use in order to justify whatever they want to say or do against the Jewish people. And in reality, it is a flimsy excuse, and I'll explain why. First of all, it's important to note that every religion, every Western religion at least, does claim a certain kind of chosenness in its doctrine. Christianity and Islam believe the same thing. Christianity believes in a concept called supersessionism, that God basically had originally chosen the Jews and they were superseded by Christians. Muslims believe that God doesn't supersede anything, but the original Bible that the Jews introduced to the world and that was enhanced or augmented by the Christians was just a corruption of the actual original scriptures, which were taught accurately to Muhammad. And therefore, anyone who does not subscribe to Islam is making a terrible mistake and is an infidel and is a dhimma, or however you're going to describe the person who's the non-Muslim within the Islamic society. So you have this concept existing. There's one very important difference between Judaism on one side and Christianity and Islam on the other side, and we really need to dispense with this right away, because our objective here is to make sure that we should not be apologetic about our belief that the Jewish people are the chosen people. And that is that Judaism, unlike Christianity and Islam, believes that you don't have to be Jewish to be beloved by God. There is no distance between the Gentile and God by virtue of the fact that the Gentile is not a Jew. For the Christian, if you do not accept Jesus, if you don't convert to Christianity, then, well, obviously Christianity is not monolithic on this point. There's obviously different theological positions within Christianity, which is a very pretty vast religion. But to some degree or another, you are either eternally damned or you're distanced from God for all of eternity. And in Islam, it's pretty much the same thing, that there's a very replete discussion in the Quran about the burning that the infidels have to go through in hell because they failed to accept Muhammad as the final prophet and their personal prophet. So in Judaism, by contrast, you don't have to be a Jew. You don't have to be a Jew in order to go to heaven. The Gemara itself acknowledges that a righteous Gentile can have a very nice chelek in Olam Haba. The only thing that we do acknowledge is that because a Jew has 613 mitzvot to perform, and a non-Jew has only 7 mitzvot to perform, the scope of responsibilities, justice only dictates that a Jew should be compensated accordingly for the 613 mitzvot that he performed throughout his life, or the whatever number is available to us in the Gola at any given point, you know, maybe if it's 200-something and not 600-something. But the point is that there are many more mitzvot, many more responsibilities that are placed upon a Jew than are placed upon a non-Jew. And a Jew is compensated for those mitzvot as having been a sort of one of God's chosen people. But that doesn't mean that the Gentile is completely rejected by Hashem. And that's why we're not interested in Rabbi Yehuda Halevi emphasizes this a couple of times in the Sefer Kuzari. The Jewish people, unlike Muslims and Christians, are not interested in proselytizing the world. That is not our mission statement. That's not what we're all about. Judaism was never about making the world Jewish. Judaism was making the world believers in Hashem and following the ways of God, but that you can do that whether you're a Jew or a non-Jew. Now, I mentioned that at the outset because what I'm about to mention at this point is the theological position of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi when he defines chosenness. And this kind of chosenness is considered to be on the extreme side of chosenness because there are other more tempered, more nuanced positions of what it means to be the chosen people. But keep that in mind as you hear the words of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who has been accused of harboring a racist doctrine within Judaism. Keep that concept of chosenness in mind, that understand that even for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who feels that there's an ontological, inherent difference between Jews and non-Jews, that we understand that it doesn't mean that non-Jews are despised by God or are consigned to eternal damnation. Chas v'shalom. Every human being is created, B'tzelem Elokim, is created in the image of God, even for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. So with that said, let's understand what his position is. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, at the very beginning of Sefer HaKuzari, sets up a hierarchy within creation. And this all relates to what we've been saying for the last 2 weeks, that for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the physical world is the arena in which God presented to us for us to serve and utilize the physical world which is infused with a certain spiritual fabric. That is what our calling is to utilize the physical world in our service of Hashem. It's not that Judaism resides in the intellect, but it resides in the physical world around us. And therefore, Kedusha, holiness, spirituality, some kind of metaphysical quality that varies from one physical place to another or one physical thing to another, will inhere in people, places, and things. And we talked about Eretz Yisrael last week in that same context, how Rabbi Yehuda Halevi understands the essential ontological Kedusha that resides in Eretz Yisrael, which is greater than any other place in the world. It's the same Rabbi Yehuda Halevi who takes the position now that there's an ontological difference between Jews and non-Jews, that there's something inherent within the Jewish people. You can call it a neshama. You can call it something else. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi calls it some kind of elite kernel that exists within the Jewish people that makes us inherently different. But he takes it even one step further. He sets up a system at the beginning of Sefer HaKuzari, which defines that there are four levels of existence, four levels in a hierarchy of sophistication of all of creation. The lowest level in this hierarchy are inanimate and inorganic creations. Rocks and metals, for example, are the lowest level of creation. They're the simplest form, and they lack all kinds of animation or nutrition. Nothing is provided to them. They're completely inorganic. They do not grow. That's the first level of all of existence. The second level of creation, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi would call the organic level, which is all of plant life, which lacks locomotion, doesn't move, but it grows and it reproduces. So that's the second level of creation. Everyone with me so far? Now let's go to the third level of creation. The third level of creation for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is the animal kingdom, where the creations of this sort of order in the hierarchy also intake nutrition and reproduce, plus they possess locomotion. What's the level after that? That's the level of humanity. The level of humanity is where it possesses all of the lower levels, which is they grow, they reproduce, they intake nutrition to help them grow, they possess locomotion, plus one other thing that the human being possesses, which is what?
Speech.
Intelligence and speech. Speech is a manifestation of human intelligence, exactly. Okay, so we've got four levels of creation. So I will quote you now from Sefer HaKuzari, Maimer Aleph, the first essay, the first section. Paragraph 37. Ask the rabbi, and what level do you think ranks above the human? The Kuzari says, there is no physical creature on a higher level than the human being. The rabbi says, I'm skipping a couple of lines, but let us say we could find a Superman who could walk through fire unscathed, who could go without food and not starve, who could radiate from his face such a bright aura that the eye could not look directly at it, and who would never become ill or weak. And when the Superman would have accomplished his life's purpose, he would die of his own accord at a set time, like someone lying down on his bed and going to sleep. And right before his death, this person would know everything that happened in the past and all that will transpire in the future. Would you not agree that this person occupies a separate level from the rest of humanity, from the rest of mankind? The Kuzari responds, when he hears this question, let's all turn off our cell phones. The Kuzari responds, this level is for a divine angelic creature, if it at all exists. This behavior belongs in the divine category, not in the human, animal, or organic categories. The rabbi says, what I have described for you are some of the qualities of one of our prophets, namely Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, Moshe Rabbeinu is a paradigm of what it means to be the ultimate Jew. And furthermore, for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, the experiences that Moshe Rabbeinu had because he was a Navi, because he was a prophet, are common to a whole class of creation which occupies a level above the human. It is the Superman, not the man. And it is therefore a completely different order of creation. And that order of creation is reserved specifically for someone who is a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. No one, and I mean no one for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, who was not a descendant of the patriarchs, is capable of occupying this level. It is a genetic quality, although Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi doesn't use the term genetic because that's a modern term, but it is a quality that can only be inherited from one's ancestors, and so that no matter how much a Gentile attempts to achieve this prophetic experience, he will fail because he is human. He is not superhuman like the Jewish people. Now that's not to say that for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, all Jews will become prophets. If anything, it's a tremendous liability if you have the potential for prophecy and you fail to realize that potential. A Gentile cannot be blamed for not being a prophet because he simply lacks the ability to achieve prophecy. But a Jew who fails to achieve prophecy, and if he has the ability to do so, is not realizing his potential and therefore could therefore be held liable by God, because why didn't you become a prophet? Why didn't you emanate an aura? Why didn't you commune and conjoin with the greatest intellectual and spiritual experience in the world, which is the prophetic experience? For Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, that is what distinguishes the Jew from the non-Jew. It is the ability for the human being to become a Navi and to have an experience that elevates the a person above the physical plane. That's the sole difference between the Jew and the non-Jew for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. And I want to emphasize this point because we need to first put this in perspective before we are tempted to condemn it as being racist. And I say this, and I attempt to say this as objectively as possible. I am not here to apologize for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. If he were to say that Jews are human beings and Goyim are monkeys, then he would say it. And I would have to say, this is what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi says, and he says it. But that's not what he says. And I want to make sure that we understand, that even those who harbor, such as Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, who harbor this kind of inherent distinction between Jews and non-Jews, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi never deprecates the non-Jew and says that he is in any way subhuman. If anything, it is the philosopher that Rabbi Yehuda represents in his work at the very beginning who is the one who treats certain classes of humanity as being what he calls barely human. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi says all humanity is the same. The Jew is the exception to humanity because he has the ability to transcend the confines of this world and have a prophetic experience of communing with God and communicating with God directly. So let's put that in perspective first of all. And and explain that the only difference between Jews and non-Jews is the prophetic experience. It does not relate to intellectual capacity. It does not relate to physical capacity. It relates to a prophetic capability, period. Another thing that that we have to point out is that that for the vast majority of the Jewish people who were not prophets, it would therefore turn out that there is no difference between a Jew and a non-Jew. If a Jew never achieves prophecy in his or her lifetime, then they are no different from a non-Jew inherently. The only thing Rabbi Yehuda Halevi does acknowledge is that he says the Jewish people all aspired towards prophecy, and many actually achieved it. Even those who did not could still be at near prophetic levels due to their desirable acts, their holiness and purity, and their attachment to other prophets. But this distinction is behavioral in nature, is a cultural difference, it's not an ontological difference. So if a person never was a Navi, and we know that the vast majority of the Jewish people in every given generation throughout Jewish history, even when prophecy was extant, were not prophets. And therefore for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, 99% of the Jewish people were no different inherently from their non-Jewish counterparts. It's the 1% or 2% or 10% of the people in a given generation who were Nevi'im, those were the people who rose to a superhuman level. So that's another thing that we have to put into perspective. Another thing that's put into perspective is that when did Nevuah cease to exist? Cease completely from human history. Chazal tell us that Nevuah stopped at the beginning of Bayis Sheni, at the beginning of the Second Temple era, with the last of the Nevi'im, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. So for the last 2,500 years or thereabouts, there have been no Nevi'im. And if that's the case, then for the last 2,500 years, this essentialist doctrine of distinguishing between Jews and non-Jews is largely a non sequitur. Okay?
Is it the potential for prophecy or actualizing the prophecy that makes the difference?
It is the actual prophecy that makes the difference, not the prophecy in potentia.
Where would you put Bilam as a non-Jew?
It's a good question. The question that I'm going to answer is, what would Rabbi Yehuda Halevi do with all of the non-Jewish prophets who seem to have existed throughout history? I'm actually going to answer it only partially until we get to the Rambam, who will provide a different point of view. But Rabbi Yehuda Halevi would have to answer, even though he doesn't say this explicitly, is that their prophecy only came about as a result of God needing to employ an instrument outside of the Jewish people to get across a message, and it wasn't a real form of prophecy the way that Jews are capable of achieving. Bilam had an artificial form of prophecy, and anyone else who had a prophecy throughout history, they would have to be explained as either having been Jewish or not really having a genuine prophecy in the conventional sense. But let me go on. How did the Jewish people acquire this prophecy according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi? How is it that the Jewish people became privy to such a superhuman kind of capacity? Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has a unique method of explaining this, and he says that it started with Adam HaRishon. That Adam HaRishon was the first superhuman, but because of certain flaws in his reproductive capabilities, he had several children, but only one inherited the super gene, the elite gene of superhumanity. And that the name of that descendant, whose name was Seth or Chase. But his other sons and daughters, didn't inherit that genetic quality of superhumanity. And so therefore, even though they may have propagated and had their various descendants, none of those descendants possessed that certain genetic inherent capability of achieving prophecy. We then go down through a chain of generations from Chase down to Noah, and then from Noah down to Abraham, and we find that those superhumans who possess this metagene or the superhuman gene are the ones who are enumerated in the Torah as he begat him and he begat him and he begat him. In other words, for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the reason why the Torah identifies the generations of mankind going from Adam to Noach and from Noach to Abraham is because it wants to tell you that out of all of humanity, these are the only individuals who inherited this superhuman genetic quality going all the way back to Adam HaRishon. It also turns out that according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, that there is a certain uniqueness about these individuals, and the reason why they lived so long, as recorded in the Torah, that the Misushelach lived 969 years, and other people that are enumerated in the Torah lived for centuries and centuries and centuries, 800, 900 years, is because they possessed this superhuman quality that created within them a physical manifestation of their superhumanity. This is itself a machlokes between the Rambam and the Ramban as to whether, when the Torah lists all of these people who lived inordinately long lives before the flood and shortly after the flood, are these people exceptions to the rule? Were they exceptional people who lived exceptionally long lives? Or was this the typical norm? The Ramban is of the opinion that people lived exceptionally long lives before the Mabul, and God changed all of nature after the Mabul so that people would live lifespans that are more analogous to ours. But the Rambam, Maimonides, disagrees, and he says it was in the Mor Nebuchim, and he says it was only those people who are identified and enumerated by the Torah who lived inordinately long lives, because the Rambam takes a more rational approach and says that people basically were the same back then as they are today, and it's only a few exceptional individuals who were descended directly from Adam down to Noach and Noach to Avram who lived exceptionally long lives. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi seems to subscribe to that as well, and he tells us that the reason why these people lived exceptionally long lives is because they possessed this metagene, this certain exceptional superhuman quality that they inherited going all the way back to Adam. Then Rabbi Yehuda Halevi points out that it was possible for this superhuman gene to skip a generation, just like you find in genetics, where sometimes grandpa will have blue eyes, grandson will have blue eyes, but papa will have brown eyes. He says the same thing can happen in spiritual genetics too, where the superhuman gene can skip a generation. And that's why we find that even though that Avraham had inherited the super gene from going all the way back to Noach and to Adam, his father Terach didn't possess the superhuman gene. Now how the Rabbi Yehuda Levi knows this, we don't know. But it seems that based upon his understanding of the life that Terach lived, it seems that Terach was incapable of rising to the occasion, and therefore he's sort of like ancillary to the rest of this line of generational progression of the superhuman gene that passes from one generation to the next. But here's what's unclear from the Kuzari, and it requires a lot of analysis. What's unclear from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is whether free will has any role to play in the ability for one to inherit this metagene. Is it something that happens genetically automatically, that I just inherit it or I don't inherit it? Or is it something that I have to do in order to be able to be worthy of it? And it seems from the commentaries on the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Moscato, who's one of the earliest of the Mefarshim to the Sefer Kuzari, from his Kol Yehuda from the 16th century, he writes that it's really a combination of both. You either, if you inherited the metagene, the superhuman, this elite gene, so then you were capable of rising to the occasion and developing it within yourself, and then you could pass it along to the next generation. However, you needed to develop it. It was something that you were born with, sort of just like if a person is born with certain athletic tendencies or capabilities, or a person is born with certain intellectual capabilities because of a good gene pool, he still has to develop those either physical or intellectual capabilities in order to be able to excel. And that seems to be what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is subscribing to, that Avraham Avinu had to develop his qualities in order to be Avraham Avinu. He had inherited something that no one else of his generation had, but had he not cultivated that quality, he would not have risen to become the Avraham Avinu and the patriarch of the Jewish people. There's a modern commentary to Sefer HaKuzari, Rav Shlomo Toledano, who wants to create a differentiation between earlier generations of this metagene to later generations. And he says, if you notice that even by Avraham Avinu's time, people were living shorter and shorter lifespans. So what happens? You're seeing a weakening of this metagene as it's being passed down from Adam to Noach. And then eventually it continues to weaken and weaken and weaken as it gets closer down the line, so that by the time you get down to Avraham Avinu, people are living less than 200 years, people are living 150 years, even the ones that have the metagene. So what happened? There must have been some kind of of compromise of the Medellin over the course of time. And he concludes that it was automatically transferred from one generation to the next without very much effort. And as the generations progressed and the Medellin weakened through the gene pool passing down from one generation to the next, you had to work harder to make sure that it would manifest within you. Avraham Avinu was the first generation of these 20 generations who inherited the super gene, who really worked supremely hard on himself so that he passed down a more refined metagene to his son Yitzchak. Yitzchak worked on himself even more and refined it further and passed it down to his son Yaakov. And Yaakov refined it to the ultimate degree, so that when it was passed down, it didn't pass down to just one of his descendants, as had been the pattern up until then, but it passed down to all 12 of his sons. And then it was permanently ensconced within all future descendants of Yaakov Avinu. And therefore, we are the beneficiaries of tremendously hard and difficult efforts that were put into this metagene by Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And no matter how you look at it, it's going to be inherently difficult. Because if an individual, it is up to the individual to exercise free will in order to activate the metagene, then what is to stop God from looking at the Jewish people one generation or one year or one day and saying, I've had enough of them. You know, the Jewish people really have not risen to the occasion. They have not risen to their potential. And therefore, I've decided to choose someone else for a while. In other words, the reason why Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has this very concretized and objectified view of what it means to be a Jew is because it creates a certain comfort, like we say in Yigdal, Lo yachalif hakel v'lo yamir daso le'olamim lezulaso, that God will never exchange the Jewish people for anyone else. That line in Yigdal was put in as a polemic to Christianity, which claims that the Jewish people have been superseded by Judaism has been superseded by Christianity. No. The doctrine of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi states that it is impossible for the Jewish people to ever lose that superhuman quality that exists within our very neshamas, even though the term neshama is not used by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in this context. And that's what makes it impossible for the Jews to lose their chosen quality. It's not because of anything that we have done. It's because of something that we have inherited genetically and is part and parcel of us. Okay. You know, I'm going to hold off on questions because I want to be able to create a certain structure of contrast now that we've explained what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi holds. Just bear in mind with me that as we've explained, that as objectified as this differentiation between Jews and non-Jews is for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, it boils down to the ability to prophesy. That is the difference between Jews and non-Jews. Okay. Now, are there others who hold that there are far vaster differences between Jews and non-Jews? I think so. I think that the more that we explore the mystical tradition that is followed in Judaism beyond Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in the 12th century, we will discover a further and further developed kind of explanation to try and describe the inherent differences that exist between Jews and non-Jews. The question, of course, that we have to ask ourselves, and I hope that you will not feel that this is in any way a heretical question that I raise, is how much of these post-medieval mystical discussions of the inherent differentiations between Jews and non-Jews were emphasized within Judaism in a way to ensure that the Jews would not intermarry and assimilate. In other words, why is it that this kind of discussion has been emphasized within Jewish society for centuries? Is it because this is essentially important for us as Jews to remember, and that we have a vital responsibility to the world because we are inherently different? Or is it because we need to remind ourselves and our children out of the fear that they're going to find a very pretty non-Jewish girl and they're going to want to marry her, and therefore we have to emphasize to them that you're basically two different species of creation. You have the metagene, she doesn't, and therefore you're not compatible. Something to think about. I'm not saying that one is right or one is wrong, and I'm not even saying that there's no virtue in emphasizing it for that reason. That may in itself be, of course, enough of a reason. and a valid reason to emphasize this concept to our children. But that's something that you have to think about carefully.
Hold on.
We will get to you. All right. Now, before we take questions from the floor, I want to get to the Rambam. If you look in the Rambam's Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, chapter 7, you will find a discussion of the principles of Nevuah, the laws of prophecy. And the Rambam describes a process of the prophetic experience, how an individual first contemplates and speculates on certain concepts within the world that exist, and thinks about God and thinks about the essential nature of creation and existence, and goes into a state of meditation until finally that individual achieves the prophetic experience. If you look carefully at the Rambam, you will not find anywhere that the Rambam writes in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah that prophecy is unique to the Jewish experience, that only Jews can achieve prophecy. Now, of course, proof by omission is not as convincing. And so therefore, if we only had the Rambam cited in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, we could say, okay, he doesn't talk about any essential difference between Jews and non-Jews as far as their ability to achieve prophecy. But the Rambam didn't just write Mishneh Torah. He wrote a number of other writings. And in one of his letters, one of his epistles that he wrote, his Igarot, that he wrote to various Jewish communities, there is one of Igeris known as Igeris Teiman, the letter that he wrote to the people of Yemen, the Jews of Yemen, who were going through some very difficult iterations of persecution on their own, and they needed some chizuk from the Rambam. They wrote a letter to the Rambam asking him certain questions. And in the course of explaining what Jews believe and don't believe, the Rambam wrote that our disbelief, and I quote here, our disbelief in the prophecies of Omar and Zaid, which are just arbitrary names, Arabic names that the Rambam used, is not due to the fact that they are non-Jews, as the unlettered folk imagine, and in the consequence of it are compelled to establish their stand from the biblical phrase, from among your own people. In other words, the Rambam says that there's an amaratsis that's circulating among the Jewish people. There are some people who erroneously believe that when the Torah says, Navi, mikir becha, that I will establish a prophet from amongst you, from among your brethren, me'achecha, kamoni, that Moshe says to the Jewish people, I will establish a prophet from your brethren just like me. To be a prophet for you, people erroneously interpret from that pasuk that only Jews are capable of being Nevi'im. The Rambam says that's erroneous, that's incorrect. What Moshe Rabbeinu was saying to the Jewish people is, a Navi for the Jewish people will be from the Jewish people. But that doesn't mean that Nevuah cannot exist within the non-Jewish nations. There could be a non-Jewish prophet who would be there to function for the non-Jewish nations. So if there was going to be someone like a Bilam or someone else who could prophesy for the people of another faraway place, that's altogether possible. If in ancient China or India someone achieved prophecy, gesuntehei, that's perfectly fine. He says for Job, so far, Bildad, Eliphaz, and Elihu, these are characters from the book of Job, are all considered prophets by us, although they are not Israelites. But we give credence to a prophet or we disbelieve him because of what he preaches, not because of his descent. And the Rambam was here explaining why we disagree with Islam. It's not because Muhammad was a goy and he was incapable of prophecy, but it was rather because he was a mishuga, because he was insane, he was mentally ill. And that's why we cannot accept the prophecies of Muhammad. Nebuch, he was mentally ill. It's not a judgment, right? Muhammad simply was wrong. And the Rambam emphasizes that in his letter to the Jews of Yemen. So you see very clearly here a very, very fundamental machlokes between the Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, which is consistent, if you'll recall, from the last couple of weeks of how we've been discussing the worldviews of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi and the Rambam. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi says that Kedusha inheres ontologically in people, places, and things, but the Rambam says that Kedusha is as a rationalist, he says that Kedusha is a concept. It is not something that can inhere into the physical world. by the very definition of the dichotomy of physicality versus spirituality, the physical world does not possess inherent qualities of Kedusha, of one thing over another, of one human being over another. We are all created with the Tzelem Elohim. All human beings are the same. The Jewish people are unique not because there's something beating within our hearts or our souls that makes us inherently meta-human, but rather it's because we were given the responsibility of observing the Torah. I hope I'm making that clear. Now we have to go to the status of converts. And then I'll open up the floor. This is the real controversial part. For Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, a convert who converts to Judaism does not possess the elite gene that Jews from birth possess. It's because even though you've committed yourself to a life of Yiddishkeit and you've gone to the mikvah and you've had your bris if you're a male and you've committed and you've become a good balabas or a balabusta, you simply were not born with the metagene. And if you were not born with the metagene, no matter how sincere and how committed you are to Yiddishkeit, you will never be able to achieve prophecy. And he writes this explicitly. If a non-Jew subscribes to the aforementioned discipline of the Torah, then he and his offspring will enjoy a large degree of closeness to God. That notwithstanding, a convert is still not equal to a Jew from birth, because only Jews from birth can achieve prophecy. Converts can accomplish their purpose by accepting the word of God from the prophets and becoming wise and saintly, but themselves cannot be prophets. Now, again, as I said, it's largely a non sequitur. I don't think that this kind of doctrine would or should prevent anyone from letting their son or daughter marry a convert. I know there's a lot of stigma to marrying a convert that many people have. Many people sometimes have a hang-up about letting their children marry a convert, but I don't think that you should rely on Rabbi Yehuda Halevi for your hang-up, because the only difference between a Jew and a non-Jew is the capability of prophecy. That's the only difference. Since you're not a prophet, I don't think it should be matter to you whether your wife, your spouse, your wife or husband is a prophet either. You have a beautiful family who are non-prophets, and you'll be very, very happy as long as you're compatible. Now, the Zohar does seem to imply, notwithstanding the Zoharic and mystical tradition that there are ontological differences between Jews and non-Jews, the Zohar still states that the neshamas of Gerim are created specifically, even before they ever convert to Judaism, there's a special status of the neshama of a Ger. The Zohar does state that the neshamas of Gerim are created through some kind of mystical unions that the neshamas of tzaddikim have in a certain area called Gan Eden HaTachton. The neshamas of deceased tzaddikim propagate other neshamas. I don't claim to understand what the Zohar means, but just bear with me. And the Zohar then says that these newly created neshamas then travel all the way up to beneath the wings of the divine presence of the Shekhinah, and the Shekhinah kisses these neshamas and then sends the respective neshama to the body of the ger who is converted. And from that moment onwards, the ger is known as a ger tzedek. I've just paraphrased what the Zohar says. Now, whether that means that according to the Zohar, a ger is capable of becoming a navi, I have no idea. I don't think that the Zohar is necessarily arguing with what the Kuzari says, but you should know that for the Zohar, there's clearly an ontological difference between a ger tzedek and a non-Jew. It just may be that there are three different categories. There's the non-Jew, there's the ger tzedek, and then there's the Jew from birth. I have no idea. These are areas which are beyond us, and as I mentioned, are largely irrelevant in our world today. I guess the last thing I want to leave you with before I open up the floor is to point out that Judaism has never made it its mission statement. The mission of the Jewish people, as I started off by saying, is not to convert the world to becoming the Jewish people. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi points out that God created a world where there are multiple hierarchies of existence. There are lower levels of creation, there are higher levels of creation. He compares all of the world to a tree. He says a tree has roots, it has bark, it has a trunk, it has branches, it has leaves, it has fruit. The Jewish people are the fruit of humanity. They are the final crowning objective of all of humanity, that God needed to create one small group of people in the world to be his messengers and to be the fulfillers of his Torah. But that is not to say that the rest of humanity serves no purpose. If the rest of humanity is like the body of a human being and the Jewish people are the heart, or the rest of humanity represents all the other components of the tree and the Jewish people represent the fruit, then there is a vital purpose for every single human being that exists in every nation that exists in the world. We are all here for one universal purpose, which is to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There is one nation out of all of the other nations that serves HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a unique and special way, but not to the exclusion of the rest of the world. The rest of the world serves HaKadosh Baruch Hu in their way, they go to heaven in their way, and we all can enjoy a great degree of attachment to Hashem. Compare that to other religions, and I think you'll find that Judaism has been the most tolerant and the most accepting of others, and has the least amount of xenophobia from other religions, at least from the other Western religions. Okay, we'll take a couple of questions. Yes?
So, what would Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's opinion be about David HaMelech, whose great-grandmother was Ruth, who was Hagar, and where from the future Mashiach ben David is going to come from? Isn't he going to be one of the greatest...
It's a very legitimate question. You'd have to answer the question, I think, in one of two ways. I think that the Gemara acknowledges that David HaMelech himself was a Navi. So where did he get his power of Navua from? It must have come because of the fact that one convert in your family line does not permanently result in a genetic defect, because there are other Jews from birth that marry into that genetic line and they contribute to their genetic qualities as well. So the parentage that David got from the father's side was what contributed to his ability to have Nevuah, even though through Ruth he could not become a Navi. That's how I would understand it. I don't know if that's correct or not, but that's the way I've been able, that's my conclusion. Yes?
So, I mean, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi believes that we have the ability to refine our genetic material. Is it only in terms of the prophecy gene?
Yes, only in terms of prophecy. Again, as I mentioned to you, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi limits himself to prophecy, but there are other commentaries who do not. Other later commentaries who say that a Jew is inherently superior perhaps in other non-descriptive ways. But again, I think it's very important for us to remember what the benefits and deficits are, what the benefits and the downsides are of promoting a chosenness doctrine. There definitely has been a history of Jewish people promoting chosenness among ourselves, but we have to also realize that there's a great price that we pay, not only incurring the wrath of anti-Semites, but also in the way that perhaps we and many of our children view with condescension the rest of the world. And that, I think, is truly unfortunate, and we have to be very, very careful the way that we teach our children to have derech eretz and respect and to accord dignity to every single human being who is created B'Tselem Elohim, even when we subscribe to a Halevian doctrine. Yes?
Any conjecture from Chazal is why Nevuah stopped.
Chazal say that the Shekhinah was banished from the world with the destruction of the first temple. And there was only residuals of Nevuah because of a layover from the first temple period. But the Shekhinah vanished, and when the Shekhinah vanished, the radio tower was no longer transmitting radio waves of Nevuah. Okay, and that's basically, that's the way Rabbi Yehuda Halevi presents it as well. Yes?
Given his viewpoint, you would think that the lineage of the Jew would come from the father, and yet, where does it start that it comes from the mother? For example, the son...
It's a Gemara in Kiddushin that says that we go after matrilineal descent.
So it kind of goes against that idea that...
Not necessarily, because status as a Jew may be somewhat different from ability to prophesy. I don't have it all worked out.
Bila, for example, she wasn't Jewish.
Well...
Shifchon weren't Jewish.
That's true. Certainly before the Torah was given, we don't have that difficulty. Before Matan Torah, there's almost a universal acceptance that the lineage was passed through the father. One's Jewishness was passed through the father. It's only after the Torah is given that shifts from the father to the mother. So you'd have to explain that the Matan Torah changed the shift of focus from the father to the mother. Yes?
I actually don't even find this thinking radical at all. It seems to me it's purely a question of potential. It doesn't seem religious at all. It's just like some people have the potential, like you made a very good analogy before about being a doctor or having a certain ability. Well, Jews have a potential, a greater potential, and that's why they have a responsibility.
Okay.
So if that is the only way that is different, it doesn't seem to me elitist at all. Really, we're all the same, but there is the potential to do greater good in the world.
If it works for you, I'm happy.
Me too.
Right. Yes.
That's a role for the guy.
David.
You mentioned that you thought that the world that the Alam had was different from what Jews had.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that?
Well, the Torah says, "Vayikar Elokim es Bilam," that God came in a happenstance, arbitrary way, when He brought His prophecy to Bilam. Chazal even make a point of saying that this was an aberrant form of prophecy. It was not something that Bilam actually had to work for and meditate over, the way the Rambam describes how a Navi normally achieves prophecy. He was given prophecy so that the Jewish people could benefit thereby from someone outside their ranks praising them. Okay.
How's Yehuda Levi and the staff of Ovadia, who was another one, who was from Helen?
It's also a good question. You'd have to say that Ovadia was a descendant of Gerim. Chazal say that he was from Gerim. So if a person is descended from Gerim, but there's an admixture of Jew from birth blood in that family line, just like David HaMelech as well, that's how we would explain Ovadia. Yeah. Okay, thank you.